a runaway turned world famous con man. Versions of Frank Abagnale's story are told all over the world. Today, we're telling it from his point of view. I'm Courtney Green.
I'm Katie Reeves.
And I'm Ezra Coopersmith. And this is Swindled and Psyched, the podcast where we explore some of the most successful scammers and hustlers in history, talk about why they worked, how they're still working, and what you can do to make sure you don't fall for them.
This podcast is brought to you by Better Business Bureau, Great West, and Pacific. The BBB has helped consumers find trustworthy businesses for over 100 years. With resources like Scam Tracker and online business records, finding trust in the marketplace is easier than ever. Visit BBB.org for more information. The opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and do not represent the opinions of Better Business Bureau, Great West, and Pacific.
So welcome to the finale of season one of Swindled and Psyched.
We made it.
We made it.
Honestly, thinking back to where we started like 2 years ago or a year, whenever that was.
God, it's almost 2 years ago.
Woo, woo, woo.
Yeah.
Not
by
for
the
me.
Time we. Yeah. You are brand new in this journey of ours, but Katie and I have been on this train forever.
We've been on this train re-recording the same podcast over and over again. So it feels and good. Feels good.
We'll actually talk about that. We've been asked to do a bonus episode. I'm not sure when that's going to air because we haven't recorded it yet. But we've been asked to do a bonus episode talking about kind of the journey to getting here. And what that's looked like, some trial and error, and a little bit more about us. So I'm excited about that, but welcome to the season finale. And we have saved one of our favorite swindles for last. And many people know Frank Abagnale's name simply because of the film Catch Me If You Can, the TV show White Collar, and there's actually a Broadway musical based off of Frank Abagnale's life as well.
Wait, hold up. There's a musical?
There's a musical.
That's
incredible. I don't know what it's called. I'll have to look it up. But there is a Broadway musical based off of his, like, loosely based. And so is White Collar is loosely based off his life. But Catch Me If You Can, I think it was the early 90s when that was made. But
2002.
Leonard, 2002. I'm always about 10 years off.
It's like, what?
But Leonardo DiCaprio, perfect role for him.
Well, and don't forget Tom Hanks.
Oh, I did forget Tom Hanks.
Wow. Sorry, Tom. He's probably listening right now and is devastated, Courtney.
Sorry, bud. But I have done countless hours of research over the last couple of years, getting the stories and good sources for this podcast. And I decided that the best source for this episode is actually Frank Abagnale. So kind of a preference or a preface.
Mm-hmm.
Words are hard.
Preface.
A preface to this story that I'm about to tell is that I watched a video that Frank Abagnale had presented to Googlers in 2017 talking about his life. And so I pretty much just kind of translated that into a different tense because it would be really weird for me to say I instead of he in this story. So I just kind of changed the tense, and I'm going to use his story from his mouth. And I'll also, I've cut out some of the conversations and like a little bit of the backstory about his family because I don't think it really like plays into what we're talking about. So if you want to watch the full video, I'm going to put it in the show notes. It's actually incredibly interesting. And the reason I love this story so much is because I actually met Frank Abagnale at an AARP kind of conversation conference kind of thing in Boise about almost 2 years ago, 2 years ago now.
Now, did you actually get to go and like actually meet him and like introduce yourself?
Yeah. Yes. I said that cool. I was with Better Business Bureau, but I didn't. I don't really think.
And then he ran away. People. He didn't want to talk to you.
I mean, there was a long line of people.
Oh, I'm sure.
So it's like,
I'm sure.
If he saw me again, he would absolutely not know who I was. But.
But you officially, anyway. You did get to say, hello, I'm Courtney. So nice to. Cool. That's awesome.
I actually don't. Now that I'm thinking about it, I don't know that I introduced myself or if I just said that I was with the Better Business Bureau.
I guess that is we're kind of taking it down. I'm taking it down a different path. Sorry.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't remember if I actually introduced myself or if I just was like, hey, I'm BBB.
I'm with BBB. And he's like, all right, moving on.
You're like the millionth BBB person I've met. So yeah. Awesome.
Well, I'm really excited to hear this story because
that's Ezra's way of saying, let's get to
start.
It.
Start.
A little bit, but I genuinely am because.
It's fine. I'm same here. We should start.
Every time I tell people that I like work at the Better Business Bureau and deal with scams, the first thing they say is like, oh, so you deal with people like the Catch Me If You Can guy. And it's one of those stories that I know about. Like, I know of it, but I have just never read much about Frank Abagnale or really learned much about his life. All I know is there's a lot of folklore surrounding him as a personality, and then there's also a reality. So I'm expecting big things from this story. Maybe
well,
even a song from the musical if you've prepped
Ooh.
That. But
oh,
we'll see.
Well, I'm going to...
I forge checks. Just kidding.
We could
Katie,
plan
I'm
a musical. A BBB musical.
I'm going to have you look that up, Katie, while we are... Or while I'm telling the story and see if we can find that. Cool. Awesome. Well, let's dive in. So Frank Abagnale was raised just north of New York City in Westchester County, New York. He was one of four children in the family, the so-called middle child of four. He was educated there by the Christian Brothers of Ireland in a private Catholic school called Iona, where he went to school from kindergarten to high school. By the time he had reached the age of 16 in the 10th grade, his parents of 22 years of marriage one day decided to get a divorce. Unlike most divorced parents, the children are usually the first to know, but his parents were really good about keeping it a secret. Frank recalls being in the 10th grade when the father, who would be sort of like the principal, walked into the classroom one afternoon and asked a brother, so like a teacher, to excuse him from class. When Frank came out in the hallway, the father handed him his books and told him that one of the brothers would drive him to the county seat in White Plains, New York, where he would meet his parents and they would explain what was going on. He remembered the brother dropped him off on the big steps of the stone building and told him to go up and his parents would meet him in the lobby. He remembered climbing up the steps, seeing a sign on the building that said family court, but didn't really understand what that meant. When he arrived in the lobby, his parents weren't there, but instead he was ushered into the back of an immense courtroom. His parents were standing in front of a judge, but he couldn't hear what the judge was saying, nor what his parents' response was. Eventually, the judge saw him at the back of the room and motioned him to approach the bench. So he walked up and stood in between his parents. He said he distinctly remembers that the judge never looked at him. He never acknowledged Frank was even standing there, but simply read from his papers and said that Frank's parents were getting divorced. Because he was 16 years old, he would have to choose which parent he wanted to live with. Frank immediately burst into tears and ran out of the courtroom. The judge then called for a recess, but by the time Frank's parents got outside, he was gone. He claims his mother didn't see him again for 7 years, and he claims that to this day, he hasn't seen or heard from his father again. In the mid-1960s, running away was super popular for young people. A lot of them got caught up in Haight-Ashbury, the hippie scene, or the drug scene. Instead, he took a few belongings from his home, packed them in a bag, boarded what was then the New Haven and Hartford Railroad for a short train ride down to Grand Central Terminal in New York. His father did own a stationery store in Manhattan, and it was located on the corner of 40th and Madison. Like many of his siblings, he had to work in that store during the summers. So from the time he was about 13, he was making deliveries on his bike for his dad during the summers. He knew the city super well, so naturally, after he ran away, he looked for the same type of work. He recalls there being a lot of signs in the windows at the time in Manhattan for stock boys and delivery boys, so he'd walk in, apply, and was always met with the same questions. How old are you, and how far did you get in high school? When he responded 16 in 10th grade, they would hire him for a low salary and a few hours. He soon realized that he couldn't support himself on the few hours he was scheduled. So he kind of realized that as long as people believed he was 16 years old, they weren't going to pay him any more money. So at the ripe age of 16, he was 6 feet tall and already had some gray hairs. His friends in school used to say that once a week when they all dressed up in a suit for mass, Frank looked more like a teacher than a 16-year-old. This is where he decided to lie about his age. In New York at the time, he had his driver's license at 16. And back then, they didn't have a photo on them. They were just kind of like an IBM card. So he decided to alter one digit of his birthday. So he was born in April of 1948, but dropped the 4 and converted it to a 3, which made him automatically 26 years old. He started to walk around applying for the same kind of work, but even with the increased pay and more hours, he still couldn't make ends meet in Manhattan. One of the few things that he had taken when he left home was his checkbook. He had a little bit of money saved up from working those summers for his dad, so every so often he would write a check to supplement his income, sometimes just $20 to $25. The funds were there, the checks were good, but it was his friends and peers who would constantly say, "You know, you're the only guy who walks into a bank in the middle of Manhattan without an account there. You don't know a soul, but you talk to someone behind the desk and they're just okay with your check." And he would tell them, "Well, yeah, but my checks are good." And they would always reply, "But if I walked in there, they wouldn't touch my check. You walk in there and they don't bat an eye." Years later, reporters would write and speculate by saying that that was his upbringing, mannerisms, the way he dressed, appearances, and even the way he spoke that would help him go undetected for so long. Whatever it was, it came really easy to Frank. So consequently, when the money ran out, he kept writing checks. Of course, the checks would start to bounce, and then the police started looking for him as a runaway. So he thought maybe it was a good time to leave New York City. Frank was a little apprehensive about going to Chicago or Miami, wondering if they would cash a check from New York with a New York driver's license in Miami as quickly as they did in Manhattan. He was walking up 42nd Street one afternoon about 5 o'clock in the evening, as a 16-year-old pondering all of these things, when he started to approach the front door of an old hotel that used to be called the Commodore Hotel, which is now the Grand Hyatt. Just as he was about to get to the front door of the hotel, out stepped an Eastern airline flight crew onto the sidewalk. He couldn't help but notice the captain, the co-pilot, the flight engineer, and about 3 or 4 flight attendants dragging their bags to the curb to load them in a van that would ultimately take them to the airport. As they loaded the van, he thought to himself, "That's it. I could pose as a pilot, I could travel all over the world for free, and I could probably get just about anybody to cash a check for me." So he walked up the street a little further to 42nd and Park, and he heard a huge helicopter, which made him look up. And there was New York Airways landing on top of the Pan Am building. Pan Am, the nation's flag carrier, the airline that flew all around the world, he thought, what a perfect airline to use. So the next day, he placed a phone call to the executive corporate offices of Pan Am. He distinctively remembers that when the phone was ringing, he had no idea what he was going to say. When he got someone on the phone, he claimed he was a pilot who was just about to take off for another flight, and the hotel he had been staying at lost his uniform in their dry cleaning system. They sent him downtown to their manufacturer in the city, where they set up Frank with a brand new uniform. So, okay, New York had 2 airports at the time, LaGuardia and Kennedy. LaGuardia was 20 minutes away from Manhattan, where he was staying, and Kennedy was about 50 minutes away. Naturally, LaGuardia, being the closer of the two, was where he went. He spent most of the morning walking around LaGuardia in the uniform, trying to figure out that now that he had this uniform, how could he get on the plane? He got a little hungry, so he went to the cafeteria in the terminal and sat down on a stool and ordered a sandwich. Moments later, a TWA crew walked in. The flight attendant sat at the booth, but the pilot's up at the counter on either side of him, the captain right next to him. Now, before deregulation of airlines, airline people thought of themselves as one big family, so they didn't hesitate a moment to talk to each other. The captain kind of just leaned over and said, "Hey, young man, how's Pan Am doing?" And Frank would respond, "Doing just fine, Captain." He would say, "Tell me, what's Pan Am doing out here in LaGuardia? Pan Am doesn't fly into LaGuardia. They only fly into Kennedy." Well, Frank picked up on that right away. So he said, "Yeah, we came into Kennedy at a layover, so I came over to visit some friends. Matter of fact, I'm on my way back to Kennedy now." "So tell me, young man, what type of equipment are you on?" This is where he found out that airline people had a lot of jargon for things. One of them is that they never call a plane or an aircraft. They call it equipment. And what type of equipment you were on meant what type of plane do you fly. Back then, a DC-8 or a 707. Of course, Frank didn't know that. He thought, type of equipment. The only equipment I'm on is this stool. They must mean the type of equipment that's on the planes I fly. So he thought, well, it has wings. They've got an engine. They always have a sticker on the engine for who manufactured the engine. So he responded to the pilot, "General Electric." All three pilots just kind of stopped eating and leaned over. And the captain said, "Oh, really? So what do you fly, a washing machine?" Frank immediately knew he said something wrong and went out the front door. He started to notice that everybody at the airline had an ID card, a plastic laminated card, much like a driver's license today. Yet, without the ID card, the uniform was virtually worthless. He went back to Manhattan, discouraged, thinking, where could I come up with a Pan American Airlines corporate ID card? He was sitting in a hotel room and noticed a big, thick Manhattan Yellow Pages. He flipped through it and looked under the word identification. There were three or four pages of companies who made convention badges, metal badges, plastic badges, police badges, fire badges, anything you could think of. So he started to call around. Finally, one company said, "Listen, most of those airline IDs are manufactured by Polaroid 3M Company. You need to call one of them." When he finally got 3M Company on the phone in Manhattan, they said, "Yeah, we manufacture Pan Am's identification system along with a number of other carriers. How come?" So Frank told them he was a purchasing officer for a major U.S. carrier. He told them he was only in New York for a few days and that the company was getting ready to expand their routes, hire a lot of new employees, and go to a formal ID system. He told them that he was very impressed with the Pan Am format, and he made an appointment to meet with a salesman that afternoon. He went dressed in a suit, and when the sales rep opened the book, he explained that they did the ID cards for United, Braniff, National, and Pan Am. So he said, "We like this Pan Am format." After some smooth talking, Frank got the salesperson to agree to making him a sample ID with his picture on it using the Pan Am formatting. It wasn't until he was leaving the building that he realized the card had a blue border across the top, about a half inch in Pan Am's color blue, but not a single thing on the card said Pan Am. No logo, no insignia, no company name. This plastic card was like a credit card, so you couldn't type on it, you couldn't write on it, and you couldn't print on it. Discouraged, he put it in his pocket and headed back for the hotel. As he was walking back, he noticed that he'd passed a hobby shop. So Frank turned around and walked back. He found out that this specific hobby shop sold model airplanes based on major airliners. So he bought a model of a Pan Am 707 cargo jet, took it back to his room, opened the box, threw out all the parts, but there at the bottom of the box was a sheet of decals that went on the model. And when soaked in a glass of water, the little Pan Am blue globe that went on the tail of the plastic plane went perfectly at the top of the plastic card. And the word Pan Am in the special styling and graphics that would have gone on the body of the plane went perfectly across the top of the card. And the clear decal on the laminated plastic made a beautiful identification card. Pan Am said that they estimated that between the ages of 16 and 18, Frank flew more than a million miles for free, boarded more than 260 commercial aircrafts in more than 26 countries around the world. Pan Am says, and keep in mind the fact that Frank did in fact pose as one of our pilots for a long period of time, but he never once stepped on board one of our aircrafts, which was true. Frank never flew Pan Am because he was afraid that someone would figure him out. So instead, he flew on everybody else. If he wanted to go somewhere, he would literally just walk into the airport, check the board, you know, hop on something like United Flight 800 to Chicago. And when he went downstairs to the door marked United Operations, he just walked in. The operations clerk would say, "Hey, Pan Am, what can we do for you?" And he would always say something like, "I was wondering if the jump seats are open on 800 blah, 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 blah to Chicago." And he would say something like, "I was open this weekend. Can I get a pink slip pass?" And they'd give him his ID right out the pass, and he'd basically get a escort by a flight attendant straight to the cockpit. So the cockpit had a captain, a co-pilot, a flight engineer, and then the seat behind the captain is called the jump seat, which is kind of like a free pass for a pilot trying to go somewhere on company time. Anyway, because pilots love to talk shop, once he picked up on the jargon of being a pilot, it was always the same conversation over and over again. Frank would step on board, they would taxi out, and the crew would always ask the same questions. How long have you been with Pan Am? What position do you fly? What kind of equipment are you on? And he had that one down perfectly. Matter of fact, whatever those pilots flew, Frank didn't fly. So he had no problem with that. Then they'd arrive in Chicago or wherever they were going, and Frank would go to the Pan Am ticket counter, but just long enough to get the attention of a passenger service rep, and he would say something like, "Excuse me, I haven't had a layover here in over a year. We're still at which hotel? Where do we stay?" And the rep would tell him which hotel he could stay at on Pan Am's dime. He would stay 2 or 3 days, and Pan Am would be directly billed for his room and any meals. He could also cash a personal check at the front desk because it was one of those kind of like courtesy things that the reciprocal agreement, that's the word I'm looking for. But then he also found out that every airline honors every other airline employee's personal checks. So that is also a reciprocal agreement that as of 2017 was still being practiced. So at the San Francisco airport, say a Delta flight attendant can walk up to an American Airlines ticket counter, show her ID, then cash a personal check up to $100 and vice versa. Of course, when Frank found that out, he'd go to places like JFK or LAX, but he wouldn't just go to one, he would go to everybody. Northeast, National, KLM, Air France. It would take him a good 8 hours to stop at every counter in every building. And by the time he got all the way around to the end of the airport, at least 8 hours had gone by. And what happens every 8 hours? A shift change. And so there were new people. He'd start all over again. As many of you know, Frank went on to impersonate a doctor in a Georgia hospital for a while. He took the bar exams in Louisiana and passed the bar, went to work for the Attorney General P.F. Gramillion in the civil division of the state court, where he spent about a year practicing law. In both the job as a lawyer and the doctor, no one ever doubted for a second that he was eligible or qualified to be in those positions. He, on his own, resigned and moved on to the next scheme. Of course, like any criminal, sooner or later you get caught, and Frank was no exception to that rule. He was arrested just once in his life when he was 21 years old by the French police in a small town in southern France called Montpellier. The French police were arresting him on an Interpol warrant issued by the Swedish police, who were looking for him for forgery in Sweden, but believed he was living in France. When the French authorities took him into custody on that warrant, they realized that he was also forging checks all over France. So they refused to honor the warrant and Sweden's request for his extradition. They later convicted Frank for forgery and sent him to French prison. When his sentence was over in France, he was extradited to Sweden, where he was later convicted for forgery in a Swedish court of law and then sent to Swedish penitentiary in Malmo, Sweden. How many times can I say Sweden there? When his prison term was up there, U.S. federal authorities took custody of him and returned him to the United States. He was then sentenced to 12 years in U.S. federal prison. He served four of the 12 years in Petersburg, Virginia. When he was 26 years old, which I find this really funny because that was the age that he lied about being when the whole thing started. So when he was 26 years old, the government offered to take him out of prison on the condition that he would go to work with an agency of the federal government for the remainder of his sentence and until his parole had been satisfactorily completed. So he agreed and he was released. So many of you know probably by now that Frank had very little to do with the film. The film Catch Me If You Can is based on his life. And he says that he would have preferred that they hadn't made a movie of his life. He's raised all three of his boys in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the same house for 25 years, and his neighbors had no idea who he was. He wished it would have stayed that way, but Steven Spielberg told Barbara Walters that he felt compelled to tell the story of Frank's life, not because of what he did, but because of what he did with his life after that. He loved the redemption side of the story and wanted the world to know it. So in the end, Frank and his family were really pleased with the outcome of the film, but they thought in a couple of years that would have all been forgotten and they could have moved on with their lives. But he never dreamed that Catch Me If You Can would go on to earn more than $1 billion for DreamWorks and be shown over and over literally every week on HBO and TV, and then become a Broadway musical and TV show. So consequently, every Monday morning when he shows up for his job at the FBI, he has emails that come from all over the world. Someone who's seen the movie maybe for the first time or watching the play at a community theater or a high school somewhere, they feel compelled to write. And of course, they come from people of all ages, some as young as 8 years old to as old as 80. Most people assume Frank won't ever read those emails or even see them, but they still feel compelled to write and make a statement. He says that some people say, you know, you're brilliant. You are an absolute genius. He claims he was neither. In fact, these are his words. I was just a child. Had I been brilliant, had I been a genius, I don't know that I would have found it necessary to break the law in order to just simply survive. And while I know that people are fascinated with what I did about some 50 years ago as a teenage boy, I've always looked upon what I did as something that was immoral, illegal, unethical, and a burden I live with every single day of my life and will until my death. And this year will be 45 years for Frank Abagnale in the FBI. So that is the story of Frank Abagnale as told from the legend himself.
Wow.
That was a lot.
I know that's the longest story I've ever done, but
it's a juicy one.
It is
very juicy.
I think it is a good perspective because I'll be honest, when watching Catch Me If You Can, now it's been a very long time, I would say that the way that Leonardo DiCaprio plays the character, you do like the character, at least I did. But I don't know if you feel as much remorse as he actually has now. You know,
right. He does say in that video that nobody ever kind of talked to him about it. They never like gave him a heads up. They never
Which is very strange.
Interviewed him. I did find out yesterday actually that it's illegal for Frank. Well, I heard this. I didn't check this out. Someone may correct me, but it's illegal for Frank to make any money off of his crimes after
the fact. Oh, yes. So, of course.
Well, yeah. So he probably didn't see a dime. Well, hopefully.
Well, he shouldn't
if
have.
He did it,
so,
if he did it right, then he didn't see a dime.
And I'm sure he did.
Money.
It sounds like he doesn't want to make money off of it. It sounds like he's trying to do everything.
Almost like embarrassed. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like, you know, what he's done with his career, because we have seen people who have a talent for, I don't want to say the S word, fraudulent activity. Often, or I don't want to say often, but you can see people just continue that behavior because they can get away with it. And he just, and it maybe he is someone who just, his disposition's just not made for long-term scheming, because it just seems like he's dedicated the rest of his life to making up for what he's done. I mean, he's working with the FBI. And I think he also has his own business where he assists people looking into fraud cases. I thought he, or like a consulting.
I think that's
business?
What he does for the FBI.
Oh, is that
is
just
that something
what he,
separate?
I thought I saw something separate, but listen, was I doing a very detailed investigative work? No.
Yeah, that's not really what this podcast is about. But I really love this story, because he went from kind of just trying to make it by swindling and bamboozling people to using the knowledge he had from doing those dirty deeds to help it not happen anymore, essentially, or to help catch really, really seasoned swindlers.
Well, so, to me, the part of the story that was a huge surprise was just how young he was when he did all of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that, you know, teenagers don't have agency, but when you're 16, you're in a lot of ways a completely different person than you are. What, 40, 50 something years later, looking back?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just wild to me. You know, he probably didn't realize, I'm completely guessing, but he might not have realized the significance of what he was doing if he was that young and just...
Nope. I'm sure,
you know,
he
in
didn't.
His mind it was, well, I can get away with all of this, so of course I'm going to fly all over the world. And then years later, you look back and you're like, what the heck was I
like
doing?
I was ballsy back then.
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, I really don't think that he as a 16-year-old, I mean, your brain is not even close to being fully developed yet. You've got another 9-10 years before that happens. So plus, I don't know, hearing that tragic story in the beginning about having to go to court, being surprised. Talk about bamboozled. Surprise, your parents are getting a divorce, and we didn't tell you. This judge is just going to... I mean, no wonder he ran away. And speaking of brain stuff, you know, that scientific term, did we want to transition to the psych?
Tell us about the brain stuff.
The brain stuff. So what I decided to look into is something ever since I have seen this story and heard about Frank and what he's gone through and what he's done in his life, what struck me are the particular positions that he decided to pose as when he was a teenager, essentially. And they were the status of airline pilot, doctor, lawyer, like very kind of stereotypically. I mean, airline pilot, listen, I don't know how to fly
just
a plane.
Pilots in it general. Looks, my dad's a pilot.
Yeah, like just pilots. And I will say domestic travel does not have the same glamour and prestige as it did back when he was posing as a Pan Am.
Right.
Pilot. It just doesn't. So that maybe has changed a bit, but pilot is still a very impressive title. And then you have a doctor and a lawyer. And these are both very, I mean, all three are very ballsy positions to pretend to be just because it's a they're significant roles. And so I was just interested, you know, kind of thinking about why, you know, he was clearly drawn to two positions that in my mind and in our culture really come with oftentimes respect and trust, even if we're not really aware of it. They're also people who often wear uniforms, not necessarily a lawyer, but it's very, you know, you look professional, you dress up. Mm-hmm. People can tell right away, usually, oh, that's somebody, or at least that's how we process it. So I was just interested in why are there certain positions that we just tend to assume that there's more prestige or status to? And so looking into this, there is a lot of research in this area. And I came across one called Social Status and Personal Perception, How Social Status Shapes Personal Perception and Evaluation, a Social Neuroscience Perspective. I'm not going to get into all of the details. I tried reading all of this. It's a lot. My brain.
Did your brain melt?
Yep. And speaking of brain stuff. And so if this is a topic, you know, of course, we'll provide this information in the show notes. So if this is a topic you may be interested in, there's a lot of research. And this particular study cites tons of different research that you can look into yourself. So looking at social hierarchy, so this is defined as a coherent and generally agreed upon ranking of a group of individuals along one or more social dimensions bearing relevance to that group. So the social hierarchy, and there's a multiple, I mean, lots of different things that come into how we've created a social hierarchy, and that will look different depending on the culture. And then within a social hierarchy, you have your status. So it's where you fall along the lines of a particular, as an individual, where you fall along the lines of a social hierarchy. And so there definitely are, what researchers agreed upon is that in general, we do have a way of ranking individuals, this social hierarchy, and it has a profound impact on how we treat others. And it has consequences in our actions and everyday life. And for the most part, you know, the neuroscience piece of it, so really looking into what parts of your brain are lighting up when this sort of things and this type of status. So I won't really get into all of that, but that's definitely a newer area of this study where they're breaking down into individual pieces of the brain to try and figure out more about why and how we categorize people. And this study in particular for the neuroscience was looking at primates. Anyway, what researchers, I mean, they really do agree that, I mean, overall findings is that if you have a perceived higher status, we just react in a more positive way. And our brain even has a more positive reactions to that. But there's also a lot of other pieces that go into it because, you know, on the one hand, it's not just the same to say, oh, you're a lawyer, high status, the end. There's also all these other pieces that go into it. And they used, I'm not going to get political, they just included an example of a presidential candidate or a president, mm-hmm. just because of how elite and how high up that status is. But that does not mean that people still find that individual even palatable, as we've known from
the last couple of presidencies.
Or just yes. how controversial it can be. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, looking at that, I mean, a presidential candidate for both major parties are high in status usually. I mean, that can be an agreed upon generality. But then when you're looking at other things that go into it, so other dimensions, finances, competence, experience, morality, dominance, all of that also contributes to the status of how we view the status dramatically. So depending on the context of the person, you may have someone who's incredibly high up, but they're viewed with contempt. And there's that's obviously not just in politics. You can find that in all other areas. So to me, after looking at this, it doesn't seem very surprising why Frank decided to pick those because, man, if he was looking, if he was a younger, if he was a teenager who was looking to get some respect and was able to pull off the uniform, incredibly intelligent individual, being able to pull off that, yes, I do have this role. I mean, it makes sense. It sounds like he got the respect and people treated him like somebody. And he wasn't looking to get a lot of money. I mean, he was looking to get by and be comfortable, but it just feels like a lot of it is just he wanted to be treated kindly. And again, with that admiration and respect that you tend to have towards individuals with that quote unquote type of ranking or social hierarchy. And the other piece of it is what they found from other research as well is that, you know, race, gender, that also definitely goes into it as well. So that goes that and typically, you know, if you are considered or how we would define a white male, that typically is seen as automatically more so in a more successful position. But that, again, that goes along with our culture. It goes along with a lot of other elements. So well, again,
especially 50 years ago when this took place, I think it's more prominent 50 years ago than it is now. We're seeing a lot of different races and genders and religious beliefs in these higher positions, CEOs, president.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're seeing a shift now. But 50 years ago, yeah, you were basically like high-fived for being a white male. And it's like, I didn't have an option.
I mean,
here.
Not to be controversial, but that still exists.
Yeah, a little bit.
But yeah, I mean, so in summary, it makes sense to me that he was able to pull this off. I mean, obviously, it takes a certain type of individual to go as far as he did.
And a certain amount of finesse.
Oh, my gosh. A talent. Truly, he is such an intelligent individual. And so it's a nice ending to the story that, yes, you can argue he did some things that weren't great. And he did. He broke the law. And what I do appreciate, though, is he has spent the time talking about it, being open about it, bringing more light into that field. So good for him.
If anybody actually watches the entire video that we'll put in the show notes that this is based off of, you'll hear that he not only like kind of apologizes for like the mistakes that he made in breaking so many laws, but he's also like, even, you know, 45 years into being in the FBI and helping them catch other people, this debt will never be repaid. Mm-hmm. Because I did so many people dirty that I could never, no matter how many years I worked, I could never right this wrong. And yeah. So I actually, Katie, I agree with what you said earlier that the way that these television shows, Broadway musicals, Catch Me If You Can, describes his life, it definitely doesn't show the amount of remorse that he seems to feel even 50 years later and doing all of these really incredible things. So,
The ending of Catch Me If You Can, I want to say, you know, it did say that Frank, and I'm blanking on Tom Hanks's character's name, but that they ended up being friends and working together. But yeah, there's not that part. One could argue that the part of his life where he's working to rebuild, that's not as interesting or controversial as the crimes itself. So that's not what's focused on.
Right.
So yeah. Oh, and P.S. I located a video of the 2011 Tony Award performance of Breaking All the Rules from Catch Me If You Can musical. So we can
put that,
that
in the show notes.
Yep. Or put it
putting
on Instagram or something so people can. But already just looking at the preview, there's some tapping, some snapping, some waving your finger in the air. So it's,
Well, it's very clear to me that the scam, and I'm going to go ahead and say the S word, but the scam in this is, Ezra, the scam in this is that it's an imposter, impersonator. It's mm-hmm. it's someone pretending to be something that they're not, and that is clear in several parts of this story. So how do we see that today? How is it kind of different than this story, but similar to what we're still seeing?
Yeah. So the way that the average person is going to encounter an imposter who's trying to get money out of them. Unless you're like an airline CEO, it's not going to be exactly the same as what Frank Abagnale was doing. But Katie, I'm really glad that you brought up this idea of status and authority, because that's going to be at the root of what, you know, today consumers are most likely to encounter. But we do hear about a lot of S words, a lot of instances of fraud where, you know, it originates with somebody basically pretending to be somebody who they're not. And a big part of the way it works, just like Frank discovered when he was a kid, is that it's a lot easier to pretend to be somebody you're not if you have a certain charisma, if you have confidence, and also if you make the other person think that you're some type of authority figure. So, you know, I think probably the type of fraud that listeners are going to be most familiar with is the IRS calling scheme. So I don't really have to explain all the details of this, because unless you've been living under a rock, you've probably gotten a few of these calls. But it's basically somebody saying, I'm from the IRS, you owe money. And the reason it works is that they're really forceful. And, you know, if you're the person receiving that call, in your mind, the person on the other end of the line has the full weight of the IRS and the federal government behind them, and they're threatening some sort of a consequence, which in reality the IRS wouldn't threaten, but you don't know that. And it's this feeling of oh my gosh, I'm not going to question. You know, this person seems to know what they're talking about. They're so forceful. I'm not going to question it. I'm just going to do what they say. But we see that with the IRS. We see that with, you know, people impersonating immigration or other types of law enforcement. But that's kind of pulling, you know, the ultimate card of authority when it's pretending to be the government and saying, we're going to do this terrible thing to you if you don't pay us money or provide your personal info. But
sorry, I'm like raising my hand.
No, go for it.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So I vaguely remember, it must have been like close to two and a half years ago. Now, mm-hmm. there was we were seeing a ton of scam tracker reports around CEO imposter emails.
Yep.
Is that something you're going to cover? Because I actually really have questions about that.
I actually don't have that specific example in my notes, but that's a really good one. So there's a whole category of fraud that we track. Usually we call it, oh my God, I'm blanking on the acronym that we use, business email compromise. BEC scams. But the idea is that these are usually, they happen internally within a workplace, or at least the perception is that it's internal. So as an example, somebody might hack into your company's email or mask their email address so it looks like it's coming from the HR department. And they're saying, hey, there's a problem with payroll. Can you send over your social security number? And of course, a lot of people, when they see that, they go, oh my goodness, this looks like it's coming from, you know, the head of our HR department, and I do not want an issue with my paycheck. So yeah, I'll send this right away. Or in other circumstances, the email might come from what looks like your boss's email. And it might even be a really wacky request, like, hey, I need you to run out and buy a bunch of prepaid gift cards and send the info right back to me. And, you know, in a certain context, if you're under a lot of stress, you think it's your boss, that's likely to work. But yeah, that's a really good example. Again, it's the confidence.
Well, taking that title,
authority.
It's exactly. Knowing that how much authority goes along with even just a title. And mm-hmm. and Ezra, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, if the IRS or any of these agencies had an issue and officially needed to get a hold of you, they would not just leave a voicemail. right?
No, and I mean, maybe at some point down the line you'll connect on the phone. But no, you're not going to out of the blue get a call from the IRS saying, pay this money that, we're going to be if you
that
owe
would come
money,
as
there's
a letter
that would
something.
First come as a letter yeah. There's an appeals process if you owe money. They're never going to demand a specific niche form of payment, so if you get that kind of a just no
it, delete no. it
also
but
if
before we end
from the government asked for Bitcoin, just toss that out.
Yeah,
right,
they're not
going
to ask you to pay Bitcoin. They're also they're not going to contact you at least the first time over text message or like social media DMs. The last thing I want to cover, though, that I do think is really relevant to the way certain schemes are carried out today is, so throughout the story, one of the things, I mean, I think it's ironic that Frank says, you know, I wasn't particularly smart. I'm sure he was. But one of the things that seems really unique was his ability to on the fly pick up little pieces of information and then use them to make basically what he is telling his, I'm using the word victim in air quotes because the person, you know, working on an airline desk isn't really a victim, but the people he's talking to make his story seem more believable. And, you know, this was decades ago, but nowadays we see that a lot with the internet and social media. And so as an example, I think we call these like imposter scams or relative. BBB has a specific term for these types of schemes. But one thing to look out for is, you know, you might get a call from somebody, and they're saying, this tends to happen to kind of adult relatives of a person. But they'll say, hey, you know, your nephew or your grandson was traveling overseas and they got arrested and you need to send a bunch of money to bail them out, or they were in a terrible accident and you need to just send money right away to pay for their medical costs. And those are a lot more viable nowadays because you can actually find out details about a real person. Mm-hmm. So in the example I just gave, it might originate because, you know, a cyber criminal is able to view the public social media accounts of that grandson or that nephew and see, okay, well, they really are traveling abroad, say, as a student in this other country. So if I drop that detail, it's going to seem really believable to the grandmother and says, well, yeah, you know, my grandson is traveling in South America right now, so that seems really believable. Or even, you know, if they mention the name of a friend that this person is supposedly with because they saw a tagged photo, it makes it a lot more believable.
Okay, so this actually reminds me of a really scary story that happened in my hometown. And I know we're already at our longest episode ever, but bear with me. Call this a hometown swindle. How about that?
Ooh.
I'm digging that. If you have any hometown swindles, go ahead and email us or send them to us over Swindled and Psyched on Instagram. Anyway, so what happened, and shout out to Curtis, you know who you are, I know you're a listener. Several years ago, Curtis, this person, got a phone call from his parents, supposedly his parents, and they were out camping. So they weren't supposed to have service or anything. And someone said that they had kidnapped his mother, and because she posts a lot of video, and Curtis, I'm sorry if I get this wrong, I know I have like the basics of this, but what happened is because she had posted things on like videos of her voice on Facebook, they were able to use her voice in certain ways to make it seem like she was in the background asking for help.
Oh my god. Ew.
And he was really scared, literally like to death. I remember when they first posted this on social media, this must have been like 3 years ago now. But he has even said, like, if you guys want to talk about this on the podcast, please like call me. I would be happy to either write out what happened or like come on. So maybe that's a bonus episode we do another time. But essentially what happened is he was trying to call his parents or like call his dad since they had captured his mom, supposedly, and they weren't answering because they were camping.
Sure.
And when they got service, they were so horrified, and they were like, no, we're okay. And I swear to you, this guy was all over social media being like, is this real? What is happening? Does anyone know where my mom is? Like, it was so scary. And what he was doing is he was trying to get money out from, like, they were like, drop off X amount of thousands of dollars in this parking lot. And he's like, I don't know how I'm going to get it, but I'm going to get it. I want my mom back. Like, it was very, very scary situation. So anyway, I will have to have Curtis on here.
I think we should, because I feel like that falls into deep fakes, which are getting worse and meaning, you know, with imposters. I mean, not only can you do that with voices, that's been around for a long time, but doing it with faces now, where you can take someone's, like, I saw one recently with Tom Cruise, where it was a deep fake. And of course, if you're the body, you have to be able to do all the mannerisms, but dang if the voice, and it was crazy. So anyway,
that's insane. Yeah, I'll connect with him and see if he can hop on for a little mini
bonus episode, or maybe even season two, who knows.
Yeah,
if we have a season two,
like, do subscribe. We officially have a season two.
Yay.
So when this airs, and we're doing this 2 weeks early. I know, I'm so bad at communicating with you guys. When this airs in 2 weeks, we're doing this 2 weeks early, but when this airs, we're going to take about a month off, so there won't be new episodes for a month, because this is the finale. And so don't expect any new episodes for about a month. This was kind of our trial season one, so season two will be longer, let me tell you already. And we'll pick that up in, like, second or third week in July. So we're going to take a little bit of time off, get the best stories we can for season two, and we will catch you next time. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to check us out on social media. We've got an Instagram page, Swindled and Psyched. And we look forward to seeing you for season two. Until next time.